Today we're going to be talking about consequences, which is the law of sowing and reaping. And this is the heart of why setting boundaries works and why it's the most effective way of dealing with people, the most respectful way of dealing with people. When we allow people to experience the consequences of their action and we don't interrupt this law of sowing and reaping, we're being like God, who never interrupts his own law of sowing and reaping unless he stands in with grace. But he's always there to love us and to escort us through various trials and valleys, even if they were of our own making. And I'm there for you, but I'm going to let you learn lessons that are going to make you want to align yourself with me. And so I am excited to give you an extremely practical lesson on how to relate to other people, particularly those in our families, in ways that will motivate them to do things right. Particularly because, as women, it's real easy for us to go into controlling or nagging mode, neither of which are effective, but they sure do feel good. But they don't work real well, do they? First of all, I want to review from last week that what a boundary is. That a boundary is our personal property line. It says, this is where I end and the rest of the world begins. It defines who you are. It defines where you end and where other people start. When we know what we want and what we don't want, what we are for and what we are against, what we love, what we hate, what is me and what is not me, we're setting boundaries. Sometimes we just need to set them to ourselves so that we understand ourselves better and we know what we will do and won't do. And sometimes we need to speak it out to other people. But that's the philosophical idea behind boundaries. But I want to give you some real-life examples. These all really happened, of people setting boundaries. I met somebody one time who told me that she moved into a house and her neighbor said, when she met her outside, she goes, where is your bathroom? And where's your walk-in closet? Because when I look through your windows, I see your lights and I want to know what you're doing. So explain to me the layout of your house. And so this lady was horrified by knowing she had her very own peeping Tom right next door. And so, you know what she did? She put up blinds. And she would, you know, close the blinds so that the lady couldn't see into her house. The next time her neighbor saw her, she said, why did you put up blinds? Now that is my friend set a boundary, and this other lady had a boundary violation. Why would you put up blinds so that I can't see into your house? And this lady was absolutely stunned. She didn't know what to say. I suggested to her that in a case like that, one of the best responses is, I can't believe you would ask such a personal question. Which doesn't give them the answer. It's not rude, but it does say, you were rude, in a very gracious way. To ask something like that, you know, I can't believe you would ask such a personal question. You can say it with a smile on your face. You can say it without an edge in your voice. And what you're saying is, you are trying to violate a boundary, and I'm not willing for you to go there. You can do that if anybody asks you how old you are or how much you weigh. You know, that works as well. I got a call. You know, I'm a calligrapher. I do hand lettering. And I got a call one day from a wedding consultant who left a message on my voicemail saying, I gave your name, or I have a name for you if you're interested. Two lesbians are having a commitment ceremony and they want to go the whole route and have invitations and the cake and the whole deal. And they're interested in having a calligrapher address the envelopes. And so I have her name for you if you're interested. And I called back the wedding consultant and I said, I really appreciate you thinking of me, but that totally violates my moral principles, you know, because that's not what God wants us to do. And so thank you for thinking of me, but I'm not available for that kind of activity. And she said, I'm not either, which is why, you know, I'm a Christian too, and which I did not know. And that's what I told her. Sorry, I can't do your quote-unquote wedding. You know, and it was good that I found out, and I had another sister in the Lord through this, but set a boundary. No, I'm not willing. Yes, it would be good money. I am not willing to go there. I'm not willing to violate my beliefs. Some of you may have heard of a young pharmacist up in Denton who was asked to fill a prescription that was an abortifacient medicine that was, you know, it's an after morning pill. And he said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. It violates my beliefs because this will cause an abortion. And he lost his job for it. That man is now an intern with Probe Ministries, and he works with my husband. And so he's one of my heroes, you know, that he would stand up and say, you know, there are lots of places you can get this filled, but I will not participate in the death of an innocent. He lost his job over it. And, you know, what's really great is there were other pharmacies who had no problem hiring somebody with moral convictions. Another boundary setting, there were a group of us, girlfriends, planning on going on vacation. And one of the women, after the plans were starting to be made, came to the rest of us and said, I hate to do this to you all, but I really don't have a peace about going. And I don't know why. All I know is God is telling me, do not go on this trip. And it was a step of faith for her. She didn't know why, and so it was like, okay, you know, you're setting a boundary. We honor that. As it turns out, something happened with her son that very weekend that God knew 3 months in advance would happen, and he just said, no, don't go. He knew she needed to be in Dallas, but she set a boundary. It's hard to go to friends and say, you know that thing we were planning on doing? I can't do it, and I can't tell you why other than God is not giving me a peace about it. But that's what boundary setting looks like. One mom set a boundary with her family by saying, I'm happy to wash your dirty clothes, but I'm asking you to turn your socks right side out. From now on, I want you to know that however your clothes go into the hamper, that's how they're going to come out of the dryer. I am not going to turn your socks right side out. I'm not going to turn your undershirts right side out. I'm asking you to do that. And if you choose not to do that, then you can have inside out socks. They'll be clean, but they'll be inside out. I'm going to ask you to do that. That is a great, you know, she was finding herself resentful. She was constantly turning the socks right to the, why can't my family do that? So she asked them to do that, and she put the responsibility on them. Very effective. Of course, with many boys, it's like, you don't have to turn them right side out. I'll wear them inside out, and then the next time I wear them, they'll turn out, you know, on the right side. That's just the way boys think. Another mom said to her child, I respect myself too much to let you be disrespectful toward me. If you start sassing and being critical of me, I am going to leave the room. I'm going to hang up, whatever. You know, the conversation is ended. I know someone who said to her husband, who was very disrespectful toward her, told her the same thing. I'm not going to allow you to be critical toward me like this anymore. I'm not going to allow you to sin against me this way. So if you start at me, I'm going to get up and leave the room. And if you follow me, I will leave the house. I am not going to allow you to do this to me. She didn't get mean. She didn't slap him or anything like that. She just said, I'm going to remove myself from a situation where you can continue to spew ugly at me. So those are some real life examples of boundary setting. That's one of the things I love about the whole subject of boundaries. And for those of you who weren't here last week, let me reiterate. I am basing a lot of this information on the book called Boundaries by two Christian writers, John Townsend and Henry Cloud, which you can get in any Christian bookstore and many used bookstores. It's absolutely a classic. They talk about the law of sowing and reaping. When God tells us that we will reap what we sow, he's not punishing us. He's telling us how things really are. It's not that God looks for ways to punish us. He's just saying, this is the world that I created. I created a world of consequences, of sowing and reaping. It would be wise for you to bring yourself in alignment with that real world. But sometimes we don't reap what we sow because somebody else steps in and reaps the consequences for us. Children who wait to the last minute, who do their school projects, which the parents then take over, the last minute. What are they learning from that? It means that what they learn, if mom and dad always step in, is I can wait as long as I want to because it's not going to make me suffer. Mom's the one who's going to stay up to 2 in the morning taking care of this. That's the lesson that they learn. Or people who keep doing dumb stuff that end up in jail and then they call mom and dad bail them out. What do they learn? Mom and dad will pay the consequences. I may be inconvenienced for a few hours by being in jail, but mom and dad will take care of it. I do not need to worry about what I do. Mom and dad will pay the consequences. That's what they're learning. Just as we can interfere with the law of gravity by catching a glass that tumbles off the table, people can interfere with the law of sowing and reaping, which you could also think of it as the law of cause and effect. God created a cause and effect universe. If you do A, B will happen. And people can step in and prevent A from going to B. They can prevent cause from resulting in effect because they step in and rescue irresponsible people. Rescuing a person from the natural consequences of their behavior enables them to continue and be an irresponsible. And they'll do it again and again, won't they? Proverbs 19:19 says, a man of great anger will bear the penalty, for if you rescue him, you will only have to do it again. Now, wasn't God smart to realize how broken and twisted the human heart is? If you bail somebody out, they're just going to keep doing the same thing over and over again, and you're going to have to bail them out again and again because you'll set up this pattern. So God says, stop bailing people out. Get out of the way so that I can teach them myself through consequences. Establishing boundaries helps people stop interrupting this law of sowing and reaping. Boundaries force the person who's doing the sowing to do the reaping. And just confronting somebody about what they're doing doesn't help. Telling them what we think about their behavior and that they need to change, that's only nagging. You're not going to feel the need to change because their behavior is not causing them any pain. Confronting an irresponsible person isn't painful to him. Only consequences are painful to an irresponsible person. That is so huge. I put that in your notes because it's so important. Only consequences teach the lesson. If a person in the book Boundaries, they write, if a person is wise, confronting them may change their behavior, but people caught in destructive patterns are usually not wise. They need to suffer consequences before they change their behavior. The Bible tells us it is worthless to confront foolish people. Proverbs 9:8 says, do not rebuke a mocker or he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man and he will love you. So often when we're dealing with boundaries, we're dealing with foolishness. We're dealing with foolish people. And foolish people become wise people by having to experience the pain of their consequences. There are several different ways to confront someone. And I give you this information because if you do have a wise person, all you have to do is show them what's going on and they will learn from it. Not everybody has to experience harsh consequences to learn if they're a wise person. One type of confronting is to inform. For example, have you ever been in line, like I've been at the return counter at Walmart or whatever, and here's this line and somebody comes up and sees the line and thinks, I don't want to wait in line. And so they go up and strike a conversation with somebody like 2 or 3 back. And then they worm their way into the line so that they don't have to wait. Now, you could get in their face, and but that's usually not real good. And, you know, people just put up defensive walls. You can inform them by saying things like, the back of the line is there. Now, that's the first step, you know, to dealing with somebody who is doing something unacceptable, is to inform them. And there's a clear message there. They know what you're saying. Excuse me, the back of the line is back here. Or I have seen this happen where someone will walk up to someone parking in a handicapped space with no placard and no plates and say, excuse me, this is a handicapped space. And you don't have any indication on your car that... You know, that that you're handicapped. I have left messages. I have written notes and put them on windshields that says, you are parked in a handicapped space and you have no placard and you have no plates and you made me walk because you took my place. Please don't park here anymore. It was confronting without shaming. Secondly, you can give I messages. You can say things like, you know, you messages are pointing, you know, and they make people feel very defensive. When you share I messages, this is how I feel, this is what I think, you're just sharing from your heart, and a wise person can receive what you're saying, such as, ooh, I was stung by your sarcasm, which I have said to people. You know, there are some people that they just whip out sarcastic comments as if they don't hurt. And I, if they're close enough, I will say, ouch, that stung me. And that's an I message. A wise person will say, oh, I'm sorry. A foolish person or a mean person says, so? But I did what I could. Another I message. It hurt my feelings when you glared at me when I made that suggestion. There's a difference between it hurt my feelings and you're a jerk. You see the difference? It hurt my feelings is an I message. You're a jerk is a pointing the finger, very hostile type of message. And then a third level of confrontation is to rebuke in love. I got, what I will never forget, someone who told me, when my dad died, I called to let you know, but you ignored my pain. Why did you not call or send a card or anything? It's like I never even told you, but I know I told you. It, you know, oh, I will never again blow off that kind of comment. You know, it just, she rebuked me in love, and it really had an impact. Proverbs 22:15 talks about foolishness being bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline removes it far from him. And sometimes we're dealing with foolish people, and they have the foolishness of a child, and it's still bound up in their heart. The rod of discipline is a type that's consequences. And so if you're dealing with foolish people, they need reality consequences. They need to be confronted with the consequences of what they've done. Life works on reality consequences. If you don't go to work, you don't have money. If you cheat on your husband, you lose intimacy with him and you may lose your marriage. If you smart mouth to cops, you will end up in jail, especially if you live in Garland. I'm not going to go any farther with that story. It wasn't me, but it was somebody close to me. Psychological and negative relational consequences usually don't motivate people to change. Here's some examples of stuff that you can pull out of your bag of tricks that are just head games, really. Getting angry, yelling at somebody. It feels good when you yell, but it generally doesn't do a whole lot because people react to your anger, not to what you're saying, not to consequences. Or sending guilt messages. Oh, that's a favorite of many women, especially mothers. After all I've done for you, you know, guilt messages are psychological torture. Nagging. Anytime you say anything more than three times, it's nagging. Someone very wise told me something recently that I really like. She said, if you have to, sometimes you say it, you ask somebody to do something and it doesn't get done. And it, for a variety of reasons, you know, it can turn into nagging, but the way you keep it from turning into nagging is you keep asking as if it were the first time you were asking. You don't say, I asked you to do this. You know, it's, honey, would you replace the light bulb in the backyard thing? And that's the way you ask the first time. And the second time when it doesn't happen after several days, honey, would you please replace the light bulb back there? And so often it's like, oh, you asked me to do that before. Uh-huh. But if there's no edge to your voice and you ask sweetly and, you know, as if it were the first time, you're being respectful and kind and, yeah, Try that. See what happens. Withdrawing love is another negative relational consequence that is hurtful. Giving somebody the cold shoulder. They do something you don't like, you freeze them out, or you refuse to talk to them, or you refuse to touch them, or they do that to you often. Withdrawing love is a psychological consequence. It's playing mind games. But they usually don't motivate people to change. If people do change, the change is usually short-lived. And it's directed only at getting the person to light up on the pressure that they're giving. True change usually comes only when someone's behavior pattern causes them to encounter reality consequences. Man, oh, rats, I did this and now I'm dealing with this. For example, one type of reality consequence is pain, such as falling off the roof or getting burned or experiencing a hangover the next day or not fitting into your clothes. Those are all different types and levels of pain. And those are the consequences that the person experiences as a result of their own actions, of their own choices. Another type of reality consequence is a loss of time. For example, when you have to do something over again because you didn't do it right the first time. That hurts. It's awful to have to try to do things over again because you weren't paying attention or you did things wrong. Or loss of money. One of my favorite ways of dealing with kids is to say things like, if you leave your stuff on the floor, I will pick it up and you will pay to get it back. I know someone that her mother would put clothes in big plastic bags and say, I'm going to charge you Goodwill prices to get these back because if I wanted to, I could take these to Goodwill and they would put a price tag on them and you would have to pay to get them back. And so I'm going to cut out the middleman. You want the shirt back? It'll cost you $1.75. You're going to have to babysit or mow the lawn or whatever it is, but you're going to have to pay to get your own stuff back because you choose to leave the stuff on the floor. This is what's going to happen. Now, another type of reality consequence, and all of these are geared at helping people learn to live in the real world. If you procrastinate, you will have to pay a late fee. Ask Blockbuster Video. They've done away with late fees, but then you end up buying the entire video, so it's easier to pay the late fee. But I mean, in the world, in the real world in which we live, if you're late getting a library book back, you pay a late fee. If you wait too long to send your packages at Christmas and you have to send it next day air, you will pay a late fee. That's the real world we live in. You procrastinate, you pay a late fee. That's a reality consequence that teaches people to live in the real world. Or the loss of possessions, such as doors and bicycles and a car. I know someone who, a teenager or young adult, lost his car for not making payments. It works that way, doesn't it? That's how repo men make a living. You don't make your car payments, you lose it. Losses of things that people enjoy, like TV and computer privileges. Having laundry done for you. You know, that is a privilege. That is not a right. Did you know that? There are a lot of people that misunderstand the difference between rights and privileges. Having someone else do your laundry is a privilege. Hot dinners are a privilege that you can lose. Going to the movies with friends or going out with anywhere with friends. Freedom is a privilege. Ask Martha Stewart. And then there are loss of people we value. If you do certain things, you're going to lose these people or you're going to lose them for a time, which is why I'm a big believer in therapeutic separations. That before the relationship is totally killed and there's no love and there's nothing but hatred and contempt, get some distance so that people are motivated to work things out. Or even with small children. You know, if you're mean to your friend, they're not going to want to play with you. You're going to lose the people that matter to you. That's a reality consequence. When we are allowed to pay for our mistakes, we learn from them. That's the world that God set up. And reality losses cause us to change our behavior. That's one of the most effective, if you're a mom or a teacher or a grandmother, you know, that's one of the most effective tools you have, is to have people lose things that matter to them. Consequences transfer the need to be responsible to the person who makes the choices. Consequences make it the other person's problem. The people that make the choice, they are the ones to suffer the consequences. One of the authors of the book Boundaries writes, "I was at a friend's house one day when I asked their 9-year-old son to go outside and shoot some baskets with me. 'I can't, have to stay inside,' he said. 'How come?' 'My mom was talking on the phone and I kept interrupting her. Too bad for me.'" That this is the lesson consequences teach a child. My behavior becomes a problem for me. Too many times, children's behavior does not become a problem for them. It does not cost them things they value. Instead, parents allow the problem to become a problem for them instead of their children. So one of the best things that anybody in a position of authority can do is allow the person that's causing the problem to experience the pain of the problem. This little kid did. Too bad for me. I can't go out and shoot baskets with you because I interrupted my mom. Too bad for me. I am paying the cost for that. So reality consequences allow the other person, instead of going, "Oh, let's fix this," allow the other person to sit in the consequences of their choices. And the way you make that happen is to say things like, "Bummer. What are you going to do about that?" Or, "What's your plan for solving this?" Or supporting someone by saying, "I'm sure you'll think of something," you know, and you're very cheerful and you're smiling and you leave them to solve the problem. Assuming, I'll get into this in a little bit, but assuming that they're old enough to do that, you know, you don't put big time consequences on a 3-year-old. But so often, we just need to let somebody deal with their own stuff. At Austin Academy, where my kids were in middle school, they have a policy, or at least they did when my kids were there, that if you forget something at home, you may not go to the office and call your parents to come bring it to you. You will deal with the consequences of not having it. Mom and Dad are not allowed to bail you out. And it's amazing how responsible those students are, because they were forced to deal with the consequences of their own action. For example, you forget your lunch. No child has ever died of starvation from missing a lunch. You know, but particularly if mom's going, "Hey, you forgot your lunch, and you're running after them. "Bummer, you forgot your lunch. Boy, I bet you were hungry. I bet you're going to be ready for dinner, aren't you?" You know, it makes it a lot easier to make sure that you remember to bring your lunch the next time if you've experienced the pain of hunger. And the one who left the lunch behind experiences the pain, not mom. Let's talk about how to respond to bad choices. When other people make bad choices, we look to God for the pattern that He sets. What does God do when we make bad choices? He gives us His love and His presence and His comfort as we live out the consequences. He doesn't condemn us and say, "You are such an idiot. I told you that was going to happen. Now look at the mess you've made." God never says that to us. He says, "Oh, honey, I love you and I will walk through this with you." He allows us to experience the consequences and He's right there supporting us in it. But He lets us experience the consequence. That's the pattern that God has. When we experience reality consequences, it's like, "I'm really sorry you have to do that. I will be with you, but I'm not going to take them away because I love you and I want you to grow. Your character, your maturity is my most important value here. And so in order for you to grow up, you need to experience the consequences, but I will be with you in it." So if somebody that you love or know makes a bad choice, the first thing you need to know is how important it is to empathize with their loss you know, acknowledge, boy, you know, where you are is a crummy place to be. I'm sorry about that. And avoid saying, I told you so. Has anyone here ever been greatly encouraged and felt loved and honored by an I told you so? It's a shaming kind of message, isn't it? I told you so. You can feel it. You can think it all you want. Just don't let it come out your mouth. My sister told me of a story where she has a very troubled stepson, and she just could not help herself. And so what she told him is, oh, Eric, too bad you don't like jail. I told you when you were in juvie that you really, really wouldn't like jail, but you wouldn't listen. And, of course, that really stopped a whole lot. Not, you know, I told you so doesn't make any difference. It makes the person who's saying it feel better, but it doesn't help the other person. It doesn't make them feel like you're empathizing with them. God doesn't say, I told you so. He doesn't shame us. He loves us. Empathy sounds like this. I'm going to give you a don't do this and a do this. Instead of saying, don't come crying to me. If you had just done your work, you wouldn't be in this mess. Instead of that, you can say, wow, it's sad that you don't get to play today. Or it's sad that you don't get to fill in the blank. Instead of saying, don't give me the it's not fair thing. You made your bed, now you lie in it. Empathy sounds like, oh, I know. I feel for you missing the game. I hate it when I don't get to do something I want. That's very empathetic. It's drawing the line so that you and the other person are on the same side of the line and the consequences are there. And you're in that with them. You're empathizing with them, but you're not fixing it. And you're not saying, I told you so. Instead of saying, well, if you would have done your chores and behaved, you would have gotten to eat with us. But maybe next time you won't be so selfish and place all of us in jeopardy of eating late. Instead of that, empathy sounds like, oh, I bet you're hungry. I hate to miss a meal too. You don't fix a meal. Just let them experience the hunger. Townsend and Cloud write, the goal is not to control people and make them do what you want. The goal is to give the choice to do what they want and then make it so painful to do the wrong thing that they don't want to do the wrong thing. That's what God does, doesn't he? He says, if you do this, you will prosper. If you disobey, you will experience the consequences. I'm going to let you choose. God gives us the gift of choice, and he says, you get to choose, but you don't get to choose the consequences. I get to choose the consequences. That's the world he set up. And so that's why it's so important. The whole deal on boundaries is making sure that consequences occur that will make it easier for people to want to choose to do the right thing. That's what God does. Children and immature adults want two incompatible things. Number one, they want to do things their way. And number two, they want things to go well for them. Basically, I want my cake and eat it too. They want to do what they want and not have to pay for it. Those are incompatible. Real life says you can do one or the other, but you can't do both. Freedom means understanding this truth and making our own choices. That's how God arranges the universe. He gives us the gift of choice. And if no one interferes with the law of sowing and reaping, we learn to make wise choices, don't we? That's how we learn wisdom, is by making unwise choices. And we're always choosing, even when we're not aware of it. I want to talk to you about running interference by reading a passage from the book Boundaries to you. Parents have difficulty allowing their children to suffer consequences. The natural tendency is to bail them out. Here's a test for you. How many late nights have you spent helping with a school project that was due the next morning but was also sprung on you the night before? The scene usually goes like this. Mom, I need some glue for my project. Sorry, dear, we don't have any. But I have to have it. The project is due tomorrow. When did you know about this assignment? 2 weeks ago. Why didn't you get the glue before now? I forgot. The nearest store open this late is 20 minutes away. How could you do this to me? Sorry, Mom, but I have to get it done or I'll get a bad grade. Okay, get in the car. Sometimes Mom is frustrated and angry, but sometimes Mom might not mind at all. But compare this with the mom who has an eye on the future, realizing that her goal and her job is to train people with integrity and with character and self-discipline. Mom, I need some glue for my project. Sorry, dear, I don't have any. But I have to have it. The project's due tomorrow. Now, what teacher would call and give you an assignment at this hour without enough time to get the supplies? Oh, come on, Mom. She gave us the assignment at school. When? 2 weeks ago. Oh, so you've had 2 weeks to get glue and your other supplies. Well, yeah, but I thought we had them. Oh, that's sad. Seems like I remember this happening with the felt you needed for your last project. Well, I don't have any, and it's past my bedtime, so I hope you can figure out something to make that doesn't require glue. Good night, honey. I'm pulling for you. Mom number two looked into the future to see what character lessons she could teach her child today so that she could ensure a better future for him. She saw a pattern developing. This is not the first time her son had made a last-minute request for material. We would not have a problem with the mom helping out in a pinch with a child who normally thinks ahead and plans responsibly and gets assignments done on time. But mom number two was not dealing with a child like that. She saw a character pattern developing that would make life difficult for her child. She saw, in the future, last-minute attempts to get projects done for a boss and losing jobs. She saw getting in trouble with the IRS for not having taxes done or information intact. She saw destroying relationships because of the tendency to not pull one's weight and depending on others to always be responsible. So, she decided not to interfere with the law of sowing and reaping. And she allowed the law to do its work. The child sowed to procrastination and would have to pay the penalty for his lack of planning. The consequences would teach him a lesson far more cheaply than learning it later in life. Whatever school privilege he was going to lose was a lot less than the adult version resulting from the same behavior. Parents often resist allowing the consequences of the law of sowing and reaping because they over-identify with the child's pain. Let children suffer the sorrow now instead of later. Suffering is inevitable. Make sure it happens when the consequences of irresponsibility are a loss of privileges, not the loss of a career or marriage. Is that not wise? And that's one of the privileges of parenting. And we see it happening in terms of, you know, helping children in the church because of the whole authority thing as well. We shape children from the time they're young to take responsibility for themselves so that the lessons that they learn in childhood and the pain that they experience from learning those lessons is so small compared to the big lessons that they could be learning if they don't learn the lesson when they're a child and they have to learn it the hard way, which is why you hear again and again of how many people turn a corner in a jail cell because they didn't learn small lessons when they were small. All of a sudden, now they're in the hoosgow, and they're surrounded by people, and they look around and go, I don't belong here, and these criminals around me are not my type of people. I'm better than this. I shouldn't be here. And I will do whatever it takes to make sure that I don't ever end up here again. And that's where they learn the lesson that didn't get learned when the consequence would have been much, much less, like getting a bad grade instead of having a record for the rest of your life. Recently, I saw a cartoon in the paper where a little kid was asking, Mom, where are my shoes? I can't find them. And Mom says, well, let's see. The last time I wore your shoes was never. I didn't wear them. I didn't leave them anywhere. You know, and that's instead of, oh, we have to find your shoes. We have to find your shoes. Wow. Wonder where you left them. That would have been you leaving them someplace and not me, right? You know, Mom didn't bail her out. There's a great book called Parenting with Love and Logic that is all about the law of sowing and reaping and allowing children and those who act like children to experience reality consequences. And so I need to add some a parenthetical insert here about you know, we don't always let kids experience their consequences, the consequences of choices or something that's happening to them. Sometimes they do need to be protected. And they suggest, these are two Christian authors, by the way, they suggest that when we step in and make children's problems our problems, are first of all when there's danger of losing life or a limb, or of making a decision that could affect them for a lifetime, which is why, for example, some parents have swooped in and taken kids out of one school and putting them in another, because they saw them going down a path where they were so surrounded by unwise, foolish, destructive peers that it was going to be sending them down a path of destruction for their adult life, and they needed to get them out of that situation, because the kid was in deeper than they could get themselves out. And the other place they say when someone should step in and bail a kid out is when the kids know that we know that they know they can't cope with the problem. It's like we all know, we're all on the same page. We know that I'm in over my head. I can't cope with this, and the consequences are significant, such as with sexual abuse. They need to be rescued. With bullying, you know, depending on what's going on, they may need to be rescued out of that. There may need to be an intervention so that people don't end up, you know, sustaining wounds to the soul for a lifetime. I want to make some suggestions on how to make consequences work for you. First of all, make the consequences a natural outflow of the crime. They need to be connected so that they make sense. So, one of my friends said to his daughter, since you took advantage of the privacy of having your own room and snuck out the window, you lose the privilege of having a door. And she said, that's awful. I can't sleep without a door. And they said, okay, then take your pillow and blanket and sleep in the bathtub. There's a door on the bathroom. Oh, is that a very effective reality consequence to sneaking out? You know, she closed the door, and they couldn't see the evil she was doing on the other side of the door, so she lost the door. We told our kids, if you leave your bicycles in the driveway, you lose them for a week. And they did. We went out and bought locks, to which, you know, we had a key rather than a combination that the kids could get into, and they left the bikes in the driveway, you know, after we told them not to, so they got locked up for a week. Never had to do that again. Ray offered me an incentive that was setting a boundary. When we used to go to Reinhardt on this side of town, and we were living in Louisville because Ray was in school at North Texas, he used to say, if you are ready for church at 7:45, we'll go out for breakfast on our way. If you're not ready at 7:45, we won't go to breakfast. It's up to you. He was setting a boundary and letting me choose. You just have no idea how self-disciplined I was on Sunday mornings. Secondly, give immediate consequences. The younger the child, the more immediate they need to be. My children are grown now, but pretty soon I'm going to have grandkids, and I get a chance to practice this all over again. A child needs to have the consequences be very closely connected to, the younger they are, it needs to happen fast. So if you say to a three-year-old, wait till your father gets home, and daddy's coming home in a week, you know, he's not going to remember what the infraction was and why the spanking is so disconnected. You know, it needs to be quick. Third, stay away from emotional consequences. Use reality consequences instead. So anger and guilt and shame are emotional consequences. Blowing up and saying terrible things that hurt somebody's soul, they don't help people get better. Feeling the pain of the loss of privileges or money or computer time, for example, or relationship, that helps them, that teaches them much better. Fourth, use relational consequences only if they concern your own feelings. For example, there are a lot of women dealing with the horrible situation of a husband with a pornography addiction. And I know of women who have said, you are disrespecting me as your wife, and you're cutting me off from your heart when you get involved in porn, so I'm not going to be available for everything that makes your life easy. So from now on, you can do your own laundry and you can sleep in another bed. I'm distancing myself from you to encourage you to face your sin, to face your problem, and get help and accountability for it. I'm not leaving the relationship. I love you. I'm totally in this marriage. I'm totally in this relationship. But I'm going to put some distance between us so that you want to go get help and you want to change this unacceptable behavior. That's a that's a relational consequence because it affects one's own heart. If someone's behavior is hurting you or others, tell them so and tell them what you plan to do about your feelings. For example, I've known people that said things like, "It saddens me when you talk to me that way. I don't like to be spoken to like that. It makes me feel far away from you. So I won't be listening to you when you're sassing me or you're disrespectful. I don't allow myself to listen to talk like that. When you want to talk differently, I will be glad to listen." And that's a relational consequence. I am not available for you to assault my ears with that kind of talk. You know, in the same way that if it was a terribly loud noise that hurt my ears, what's coming out of your mouth is a terrible noise that's hurting my heart, and I'm going to remove myself. I'm not going to allow myself to listen to that. Another type of boundary. If you're going to choose to disrespect me like that, then I will not be available to do kind things for you. I will not be driving you to soccer practice today. Maybe next time I'll be available if you're kind and respectful toward me. It's just amazing how often kids will just say the most horrible, disrespectful, disgusting things to their parents, and their mom especially, and mom turns around and continues to do all the wonderful, nice things for them and wonders, why did she keep doing that? Because there's no consequence to it. It's not costing her anything to be disrespectful. And I don't know about you, but I have noticed that because of the culture that we're in, there's a culture of disrespect toward adults that is greater than it's ever been. And even kids who grow up in loving, respectful homes, you know, can get polluted by you know, TV, by kids at school, by kids at church. They can get polluted by it. And, you know, they didn't learn it at home. They picked it up somewhere along the line. Unless there's a consequence to it, why wouldn't they continue? Because, you know, it's just the acceptable type of culture that we're in. You know, disrespect isn't just really ugly words. It's things like rolling the eyes. There's a lot of body language that's very disrespectful. You know, just talk to the hand because the ears ain't listening, that kind of thing. You know, and when children show disrespect, there ought to be a cost to it so that they realize, you know, being disrespectful to my parents just really isn't a good plan. Number five, think of consequences as protecting yourself and the rest of the family from the behavior of the person who's doing the offending. There is a protection element that goes on when you put boundaries in place. You're protecting other people. For example, I don't like to eat with people bickering. Jimmy, you go to your room, and when you can stop bickering, you can return to dinner. And by the way, I clear the table at 7:30, and there is no more food after that. Later snacks are only for those who ate dinner. That kind of setting a boundary is protecting the rest of the family from that ugly kind of behavior. Secondly, we like to use family areas like the living room for the family. We don't like to trip over your stuff there. I will impound any toys or clothes or whatever you have left that are still out when I go to bed because we don't like a messy living room, and you will have to pay to get them back. By the way, when you set a boundary like this, one of the most important keys to doing it is to not have an edge in your voice, to say it lovingly with a smile on your face so that people are not reacting to the emotion and they're not reacting to the anger. They're reacting to the words that are telling them what life is going to be like if they don't, you know, do what they need to do. Because if all they're doing is reacting to the anger, they're not dealing with the consequences. It's far more effective when you keep the edge out of your voice, so that they hear, this is what's going to happen. If you do A, this is what's going to happen with B. And they hear it if the emotion isn't in your voice. You can say the same words, and if it's full of energy and angst and you're yelling, the words get lost. They just are reacting against your feelings. Another example of protecting yourself and the rest of the family. Hey, it's not safe for drivers to be distracted by people who are fighting in the car. If you fight, I'm going to pull over to the side of the road and wait for you to stop. It may make you late, and that would be so sad. Of course, the hard part is if you have to pull over and stop, and it's going to make you late, which is that's the hard thing. Somebody else's garbage costs you. And then because this is training in families, you know, it's we have to do things over and over again because we're training people in the right way to do things. It may mean a change in the way, okay, we're going to need to always leave 15 minutes early to give you time to do, you know, so that if I need to pull off to the side of the road, you won't make me late. You know, it's going to cost you 15 minutes of sleep. It's going to cost you 15 minutes of TV watching. It's going to cost you 15 minutes of listening to music or whatever, because I can't always know that you're going to behave yourself. So you will pay the 15 minutes up front rather than me getting so anxious because you're costing me by making me late. Or something that has nothing to do with kids, nothing to do with families, has a lot to do with church. Setting a boundary such as saying, you know what, I'm not comfortable listening to gossip, so let's talk about something else. Have you ever been in a situation with two or three or more people, particularly women, where it kind of goes off the road into gossip? If one person says, you know, I'm not comfortable talking about somebody behind their back, let's talk about something else. It's very convicting, isn't it? But that's all it takes, is one person calling it what it is and redirecting the conversation. That is it's a wonderful boundary setting. Number six, offer a choice whenever possible, even when there's only one course of action available, because there's always the choice of attitude, even if of actions isn't necessarily negotiable, attitude is. For example, you can go and have fun with us, or you can go and not try and have fun with us. Which would you like? What kind of attitude are you going to have? And by the way, if you're a pain for us to be around, we'll have to remember that when it's time to go to the movies. You know, you can choose your attitude. You can choose, you don't even have to be cheerful, but I would like you to act cheerful. You don't have to be cordial and polite. I mean, you don't have to feel it on the inside, but what comes out of your mouth needs to be polite, even if you don't feel it. That's not teaching a child to be hypocritical. It's teaching a child self-control. And that's one of the fruits of the Spirit. You can be undisciplined and have ugly things come out of your mouth and be a grump. Or you can choose to act like a polite young person or old person that you are, but there will be consequences either way. And number seven, make sure there's a good reason someone's having behavior problems before invoking consequences. For example, with children, check to make sure they're not afraid or tired or hungry or in emotional pain. Those of you who work in church nursery and in the children's department, and you probably, you know, have many years of remembering this, if there's something bad going on at home, kids are going to act out at church. And they don't need to be disciplined. They need to be loved on. Because, you know, if mom and dad are fighting or getting a divorce, or if grandpa just died, or if they just buried a pet, and this child is in great pain inside, they're going to go ballistic. And you don't give consequences for that. You just scoop them up in your arms. Tell me about what's going on, you know, and you love on them. So we need to find out what the reasons are for why people are doing what they're doing. Some people have to deal with PMS in teenage daughters, or those who are threatening to go in that direction. And you can express empathy by saying things like, you know, I know your hormones are raging, but please choose your words carefully so you don't inflict pain on the rest of us. Because someone can feel just, you know, have this raging hormone storm inside, we are always in control of what comes out of our mouths, aren't we? Because God made us in His image to be volitional creatures. We choose the things we say. And you can feel awful inside, but we still choose what comes out. And somebody says, I can't help it. No, that's not true. Because if you were in front of a police officer or the principal of your school or something, suddenly things would be very different, and that kind of stuff would not be coming out of your mouth. Yes, you can control it. You know, you may not want to, but yes, you can. And also, sometimes when you get to the other stage of life and you're dealing with parents, elderly parents, and they may have health or medical issues that make them unreasonable and cranky, and we need to give them grace. You don't give them consequences. You know, when somebody is taking chemotherapy and they just, you know, their world has shrunk down to the size of a straw and they're looking through the world that way, and that's all they're doing is surviving one day at a time, sometimes one 10-minute period at a time, you don't go, all right, that's enough of that. Enough of this crankiness. You know, let's hop to it. You don't give consequences if something's going on that is causing great deal of difficulty and pain. So we need to be looking at what's happening in the bigger picture as well. And then just in closing, I want to share, you may not need this at all, but I'm going to give it to you anywhere. There's a lady named Brenda Byrd who is a very wise lady who understands this whole consequences thing. And she has come up with a list of powerful phrases for adults who live and work with older children and teens. And she says, use these phrases when you're tempted to lecture or offer your opinion or rant and rave. You know, none of which are effective. But choose one and repeat it over and over as necessary. And what it does is, again, it draws a line in the sand and it puts you on the same side as the person that you're dealing with and consequences on the other. And it allows you to be empathetic. So she suggests phrases such as, how sad, which is appropriate, and, you know, like, I have a paper due tomorrow and I don't know how to type. You need to type it. Oh, how sad. Oh, it's going to be a long night for you, isn't it? Doing the hunting and pecking. I know. You know, I know, said with a great deal of empathy in your voice, nodding. Oh, I know, that's hard. Or, what are you going to do? Basically, you're putting the ball back in the other person's court. I love this one. I respect you too much to argue. You know, it takes two people to have an argument, doesn't it? You can't argue if the other person is gone and refuses to engage. I respect myself too much to listen to this. Another is, you do not have permission to talk like that in my classroom or in my home or to me. You do not have permission to talk that way. Putting up the walls. How can we work together to help you succeed? What a great invitation. She also brings up that great word, oh, bummer. You know, I'm not bailing you out. I'm just empathizing that you've got a pickle, don't you? And this one is incredibly powerful. I'm trying to understand here. And what you're doing is giving someone an opportunity to open the door and help you get why they're doing what they're doing, why they're thinking what they're thinking. So often we can assume that we know everything, and this is honestly one of the best things I have ever heard. And my husband, I hear him, who is a diplomat par excellence, and I hear him do this a lot. Help me understand here. You know, this is what I'm seeing. What part am I not seeing? And he will invite people to provide the missing puzzle pieces. This is a tremendously respectful way of dealing with someone. I love this next one. Try not to worry. The way she specifically suggested is, like, if somebody does something that kind of blows your socks off, you can't believe they did that, and you have no idea what you're going to do about it. You don't have to make up a decision and decide what the consequences are right then. This is, can put yourself in the place of a fourth grade boy who hears his mom say, okay, this is what happened, and I haven't decided what the consequence will be about this, but I'm going to spend some time thinking about it, and I will let you know. And in the meantime, try not to worry. That's great. I mean, you're putting the ball in their court. I mean, and that's, you say it sweetly, and they're suffering much more than they probably will when you give them the consequences. But I just think that's hilarious. Try not to worry. Another question, what's your plan for solving this? Rather than, okay, I've got a problem and you need to fix it. Oh, really? And what's your plan for solving this? And another way of acknowledging that you've heard, even if it's really, really dumb, is, now, that's a thought. You're not using the adjective to describe what kind of thought it is, but that's a thought. Another one is, I know you can handle this, which is expressing confidence in the other person's ability to figure out a way to deal with the reality consequences of their own choice. And the final one is, I'm sure you'll think of something. Again, I'm not going to take responsibility for something that is your problem, but I'm confident that you'll think of something. So these are some, I think these are very practical suggestions of how to establish reality consequences with people by setting boundaries.